minutes ago. I'm looking real good in my passport photo. Amateur Traveler, episode 811. Today, the Amateur Traveler talks about peaks and lakes, tunnels and World War I, multi-day hiking, and refugios. As we talk about hiking the Alta Via 1 in the Dolomites of Italy. Welcome to the Amateur Traveler. I'm your host, Chris Christensen. Let's talk about the Dolomites in northern Italy. I'd like to welcome to the show Morgan Fielder from cravetheplanet.com, who's come to talk to us about a beautiful region in northern Italy. Morgan, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Chris.
And what are we talking about today?
So we're talking about the Dolomites in northern Italy and using Cortina d'Ampezzo as a home base.
Excellent. And what's your connection with the region?
My connection with the region is that it's become an annual family pilgrimage. So every summer, the kids and family, friends from all over the world, we meet there and we do a five-day hut-to-hut hiking trip through the Dolomites on the Alta Via 1 trail.
Excellent. And why should someone else do that? Why should someone go to the Dolomites?
Somebody that wants to ignite wonder and just be in a place where the landscape is so spectacular, you forget cars even exist. But then at the end of the night, you get a three-course dinner served with local wines from an Oma cooking in a family-run mountain lodge.
Excellent. And I felt a little silly asking the question, why should someone go to the Dolomites? I'm just assuming that everyone hasn't necessarily seen a picture of these spectacularly jagged peaks here up in northern Italy. So if
they
probably were like, psh, Chris, everybody knows that.
I don't know that they're that popular. They should be with locals and Italians, Germans, of course, but at least people coming from North America hear about the Alps. But the Dolomites are this one special section, and they are, in and of themselves, just the mountains are a UNESCO World Heritage Site.
Excellent. I didn't realize that. I'm not surprised, but I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
And what kind of itinerary are you going to recommend for us?
So normally, I think if people are coming from outside Europe, Venice is a great place to fly into. That's on everyone's bucket list. It's iconic for a reason, but it can feel a little bit like you're on a cattle call sometimes in Venice. And so you check that off your bucket list. And then just 2.5 hours north of Venice is where this town of Cortina d'Ampezzo is. And it's a great home base to explore different places within the Dolomites themselves. And you can leave behind all your stress and just connect to nature.
And you mentioned Cortina d'Ampezzo. And what am I going to find there? You can describe it because I don't think it looks Italian.
Yeah, that's a really interesting thing. So this area of the Dolomites, it's at the intersection of like everything. So I would say you can get your nature and your culture together and you don't really have to sacrifice. And so you have the German culture there, you have the Italian culture there, and you never know if the sign is going to say a refugio or is it a hütte. So one is in Italian and one is in German. My Italian friends joke it's where like movie stars go for their summer holidays because you're walking around the downtown area of Cortina. It's got a beautiful pedestrian area with shops with like $8,000 coats in the windows that you can go try on. But then you're 10 minutes from a cable car going up to a 10,000 foot mountain, or hikers in their muddy boots and their walking sticks right next to a lady that's wearing like high heels and has one of those little white fluffy dogs. So it's a great mix, really.
And you're recommending this as a non-winter destination because we're doing hiking here, but it's a popular winter destination as well.
It is. Actually, they're hosting the Olympics in 2026. And they
I didn't realize that. Okay.
I think it's a joint between Milano and Cortina. Definitely a winter skiing destination. That's on my list for this winter. I haven't done it in the winter so far. They actually have lifts that are connected, I think, just hundreds and hundreds of kilometers of where you can basically ski around the entire Dolomites.
Okay. Got it.
But in summer, the reason why I find it to be such an interesting place is because you can do some luxurious things in Cortina. The spa hotels there are out of this world, like something to save for after the hike, but generally...
Is there a particular one that you would recommend, a favorite?
Yes, the Cristallo. It's named after one of the mountains there. That hotel we stayed at last year after the five-day trek as a, like a little cherry on top, a reward, because the hike is hard, but you go in and the... like the shower room before you go in the sauna. It has stations where you're almost like a those old school car washes where you pull the car in and then you get soap spit at you, then you, it moves forward and then there's a different layer of whatever.
Okay,
except
yes.
It's you in your swimsuit and you step in the first one and it's a light mist with like essential oil soft water. Then you step forward and it automatically turns on and then it's like a scrubbing with like evergreen smelling and you're walking over like different kinds of stones on the floor for your foot massage. Yeah, it's pretty nice. That's for sure.
Okay, interesting. Anything else we want to do there before we get on to our hike here? Because I know that's really what you wanted to highlight.
Yeah. So definitely it's nice to get up to Cortina from Venice. So it does take some time and it is a beautiful drive. It doesn't take very long to get out of the Veneto area and you're driving through vineyards and you're going up mountain passes. So generally that first day, I would recommend that you take your time on the drive, enjoy it, check into a hotel in Cortina and just get yourself ready for the trek because you want to get a very good night's sleep. So walking around the pedestrian area in Cortina d'Ampezzo, getting a gelato dinner, just the traditional, what you think about for like the Italian experience. Because in the morning, you want to start the trek. And while it is this beautiful, stunning mountain area, the trailhead of the Altavia One is at one of the most popular lakes in Italy. So really, you want to beat the crowds in the morning. Okay. There's actually a TV show, like a Italian drama that was filmed there. So it's a place where a lot of people try to get to for like 11 or 12 o'clock. But we're smart tourists, so we get there at 8 and we can have the lake pretty much to ourselves.
Okay. And what's next?
So generally, it's a lot easier to leave your car at the hotel. And there's a very comprehensive bus system that runs that's inexpensive and very reliable. So you're going to want to take this bus from one of the villages, maybe 20 minutes away from the trailhead at Lago di Braice. And you're going to show up on the first bus around 8 o'clock in the morning. So that means that you can be first in line to rent one of the handcrafted wooden rowboats to go out on the lake.
Okay.
Yeah. When people look online and they do see pictures of Lago di Braice in the Dolomites, it's just this milky turquoise blue lake that's perfectly still because there's no outlet. Like all the water drains down from the lake. So it makes it wonderful for photography and just it's perfectly still and surrounded by mountains. So I would say definitely plan to try to get on one of the boats for probably 30 minutes should be good enough. It would be nice to stay longer, but it is a long day's trek. So yeah, they have breakfast, like a coffee and delicious pastries right there on the lake where they have a hotel. You don't really have to plan ahead too much. You can get your food there on the trail. And if you are going to be doing this trek, so it's 5 days, and basically any luggage that you brought with you for your city breaks or whatnot, or you can just leave that in your car. And what people do is they just get a small backpack and they bring a change of clothes and then they bring their hiking clothes. And there's a few toiletries. The huts, the places that you stay, these mountain huts or lodges, they pretty much provide everything that you need. So you really do want to keep your pack very light. That makes it a lot more enjoyable.
Well, I think I saw the elevation gain one segment was like 6,000 feet or something like that. So there's going to be some serious hiking here.
I would say it's
so the
serious,
less you carry, the better.
It's the golden rule and everyone brings too much stuff every time. But yeah, the first day after exploring the lake, you want to probably start moving up the trail before about 10 o'clock. It's summer and it's not extremely hot in the Dolomites, but it's a lot of uphill on the first day. So you do want to get moving. And it basically, you walk to the other side of the lake people that are just visiting the lake can just do a flat stroll around the lake, which mm-hmm. is really nice, because that's for people that aren't really into the super hiking and they just want to see the lakes. That's totally a wonderful experience too. But at the other end of the lake, you'll start up a trail, and it's going to go up for about 2.5 hours, which
okay.
is a good start. But what's really nice is that every time you stop to take a break and you just turn around and look behind you, and you can see Lago de Braise in the distance. And it's, again, this perfectly blue, milky lake that's just stunning.
Now, you're over a mile up, I think, when you start here. So have you ever done it where you stay for a couple of days to just get a little more used to the altitude before you start, or do you just jump right in?
No, I live in a fairly low elevation place, but it doesn't mm-hmm. tend to give too many people challenges with okay. altitude. I think generally once you get going above 9,000 feet, more people have issues, but of course everyone has their own tolerance level, but it's not usually much of a concern for most people. But what one could do as well is just make sure you could spend an extra day in Cortina before just exploring the local. You can do small day hikes, for example.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. So one, the natural stopping point for lunch is a place called Refugio Biela, and it's a welcome sight because you've been climbing for 2.5 hours. And none of this climbing is requiring anything other than a pair of hiking boots or like trail running shoes. It's not mountaineering, for example. It's more just aggressive hiking. But mm-hmm. this hut, it's the first one you get to, and it's just like a panoramic view, and you just feel like you're on top of the world, and you've walked through forests, and then you've walked through like a moonscape of horizontal white limestone, and then you get to the top, and then it's that sort of traditional like alpine jagged peak in 360 mm-hmm. degrees. So it's cool because you see all these different landscapes as you're walking, even just in the same day. But yeah, Refugio Biela is there, and you get basically like an a la carte lunch, and they have beer on tap and wine and colas, and then you get generally something heavy like pasta because you've definitely earned it. But usually the huts, they have an arrangement maybe somewhere between, it depends, but somewhere between 5 to 10 different kinds of things on the menu. But they're okay. actually bringing everything up by Jeep on a like mm-hmm. a little mountain road. So it's quite impressive the quality of food that they have in the middle of nowhere.
And I'm assuming that for the lunch stop, this mm-hmm. particular stop, that I don't necessarily have to have a reservation, but if I'm going to sleep in a hut, I probably need to have booked that ahead.
Yeah, definitely. Stopping for food is definitely, that's a major part of their business, but these huts book up 6 to 9 months in advance.
That's what was going to be my question. Okay.
Yeah. It used to be pre-COVID.
I didn't know how far in advance. Okay.
Yeah. It took me a while to figure it out. The first year I went was 2020. So it was in the throes of COVID. So I got really lucky. I made my bookings incorrectly because I didn't know what I was doing. These things are not on booking. They're not on any kind of travel aggregator. The huts mm-hmm. are family owned, and the language barrier. So it's not so easy to call necessarily unless you speak Italian or German.
Okay.
But usually it's this back and forth email and trying to arrange the huts in sequential order of the days that you're doing the hike. So it's a very high touch planning process.
And you have to get all of them to know that you can do the starting date you want, which seems complicated. Yes, are there any services of somebody who can can get you all of those huts rather than you doing it one by one in Italian yeah. or German?
Yeah, absolutely. There actually are quite a few. I think they typically are calling themselves like unguided adventures, or okay. I think the British are into this, so they might call it like a walking holiday. But yeah, there's services that do that. But I have 2 kids and a husband, and I saw the price for it, and I was like, yeah, okay. I'm going to figure this out myself. And I did, and we wanted to go again, and I had to recreate the wheel again, and it's a lot of Excel spreadsheets, and I was getting a little bit stressed out with it. That's the reason I started my blog, honestly. It's because I'm like, I have to put this in a central place where I can remember how to do this mm-hmm. and who to email and what their name sure. is. And then, yeah, so I actually created like a tool, and I put it up on my blog so that if anybody else wanted to do this, they could just take the Excel spreadsheet that I made and then recreate their own itinerary.
Got it.
Yeah. Okay. So they're not terribly expensive either for where they are, which as an American, I had never really known that this kind of a thing existed because we don't have a lot of that in the States.
And you say not very expensive. The day we were recording this, the euro just dropped below the dollar in value.
I know.
Which is weird and so short term, maybe. I haven't seen it that way before. So everything on Europe is on sale right now.
If you're
someone who has spending dollars, so.
You should, if you can, I would definitely go right away because it is unprecedented.
Unfortunately, the flights are not on sale, but once you get there, everything else is.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Well, you were at Refugio Biella and yes. You had a good pasta lunch here and a beer or wine. I'm not sure what your preference here, but.
Yeah, we, from Refugio Biella, you actually have gone uphill for mostly for the day. So from here on out, you walk down a little.
So you can get the beer, is what you're saying.
Yes. Beer is hydrating, right? Red wine, maybe you get to wait until dinner time.
Okay.
Actually, here it's very popular, especially in Germany where I live, but also throughout the Alps, to do what's called a Schorle, where you mix fizzy water, like a sparkling water and white wine. That's more of a hiker drink, I think. It's got to stay hydrated.
Sure.
But yeah, you walk down the jeep track past the hut. They keep chickens there so they can have fresh eggs for breakfast for the people who are actually staying at that hut. And then you take a turn and basically go on to what feels like green meadow, like a shepherd's trail. And you stay on that for kind of rambles up and down a little bit, but it's really gentle compared to what you just did. And that heads toward the Refugio Fodara Vedla, which is where the night's stop is going to be.
Okay.
Yeah. And Fodara Vedla, I love it because it was founded in 1979. The year I was born, and it's been owned by the same family the whole time. So you see mom checking people in, dad serving drinks, and various other members of the family going around making the huta function. And the reason I picked this particular hut, because generally there's about three or four different huts that are about the right distance, but this one's famous for its food. So
okay,
that's why. We make it there, and it's settled right in a little green valley with a lot of cows, the cute alpine cows with the long eyelashes and the bells on their necks. They're always wandering up onto the deck because the water trough, there's like natural springs throughout the trail where they'll have a trough, like a wooden trough, and then the spring water will be flowing into it from a spout. So you can fill up your water bottles there, and then the cows are doing it too.
Got it.
And that's the end of day one. So Fodara Vedla, when you actually arrange to stay in these huts, you sometimes have a choice to have a private room, which would be a little bit more expensive. Maybe there's two people in the little room, or it's a dormitory with generally somewhere between four beds to six beds.
Okay.
And if you have six people in your party, you might just take that whole room with six beds. But if not, you do have to be prepared that you would be sharing with some other people if you don't arrange the private rooms for yourself.
Okay.
But they're not dorms like what most people think about dorms. They're just basically trying to create enough comfortable beds. People have a shelter along the trail. So they're actually quite nice. And they come with the towels and linens and toiletries and whatnot. And generally, you can never wear your muddy boots inside these mountain lodges. So you go down to this, if they double as a ski lodge, usually they'll have drying racks. So you go put your boots there, you go get cleaned up, put on your dinner clothes. And generally you're there with maybe two hours to spare. So you sit out on the deck and have a drink or talk with your friends, relax, kind of get your feet up pretty much. And then anyone that's there as a day trip or has just doing a day hike and got lunch and are leaving, they usually clear out around, I would say easily 5:30 to 6:30 because they need to get back down to the valley before dark. So you're left there with the other hikers. Most of the time you've seen them throughout the day. You may pass back and forth. And most of the people in these huts in the summertime generally start in the same place and are going to the same place. So it's a little bit communal.
So you're seeing familiar faces by the second day.
Yeah, definitely. Strange story. Last year, I organized a group of 14 of us to do it together. And my husband's best friend from before college, Dave, was getting married. So actually him and his wife were on honeymoon in Europe. And we met in Venice, and then we all did the hike together. And we were talking at dinner, and the next table over, turns out these two men and her went to the same high school in Pennsylvania. It's crazy. Super small world.
Well, and you mentioned, I didn't want to let it go, muddy boots. So yeah. That begs a couple questions. One is weather. What kind of weather am I going to see? And two is, what time of year are you recommending we're doing the hike?
Yeah, so these hikes are only possible from mid-June to mid-October.
Okay.
Otherwise, there could be terrible weather. And honestly, I wouldn't recommend the mid-June because you can have a freak snowstorm. And on this trail, there are parts that are fairly low, not fairly low, but they're manageable, but you have to go over some very steep mountain passes. Mm-hmm. And if there's a lightning storm or a snowstorm, you could really get stuck. And the good thing is you can always, in this area, you can almost always find a way to get off the mountain. And at the bottom of the mountain, there will be a bus stop. And that bus might be a long way around, but you can almost always find a way, if there's a really bad weather, to use the buses to get to your next location if needed.
Okay.
With a combination of cable cars. So I would say beginning of July would be great, and then September would be ideal. August is when people like me have to go because we have kids.
Right.
It tends to get a little bit more crowded and a little bit more, you just have to plan further ahead, of course, to get the huts that you want. And as far as the weather, it is a reality that there is rain in the Alps. You want to definitely be prepared with a raincoat. I don't think it's necessary to have the full suit and kind of all of that kind of stuff, but just a raincoat, because you're probably going to have, kind of like in Florida where it rains every day for a little bit. We've been very lucky and we haven't had full day thunder and rainstorms since whenever we've been there, but it could happen. So you do need to be a little bit flexible. The nice thing about it is these huts do not take your full money. So they know things happen like injuries or really bad weather. So you pay a deposit and then you pay it up in full when you actually finish your stay there.
Okay. Interesting.
Yeah.
Excellent. We're on to day two now.
So when you wake up in the morning, you walk downstairs to the communal dining area and they'll have a buffet breakfast. The typical fare in these places is, I feel like it's fairly German. It seems very similar to what I'm used to.
Cheeses and meats and things like that and some muesli.
Fresh bread. Yogurt. Muesli, fresh bread, juice. For some reason, Europeans don't like to drink water with breakfast, which I find strange. But coffee, and everywhere we stay, you can always order cappuccinos and like typical espresso drinks if you want that as well. Okay. And fresh fruit, usually. And frequently, it depends on the hut. They'll ask you the night before, like what kind of bread you want and what kind of breakfast items that you want, so they can tailor it a little bit more to you. And then some are just pure buffets. So some are better than others for sure, but they're quite good. At least on this section of the Altavia one, it's quite good. So,
yeah. And you say this section, how long is the entire Altavia one?
Yeah, so the entire Altavia one should take at least 9 to 11 days. And that's something that we haven't done the entire thing because I don't want my kids to hate me.
Fair enough.
Maybe when they're a little older.
When they start clamoring for it. Okay.
Yeah. You want to leave them wanting just a little bit.
Okay. Sure.
Yeah. So after breakfast, typically you go up, change into your hiking clothes. You always want to spend the money on like quick drying clothes so that you can rinse them out in the sink. Mm-hmm. Put your clothes back on, get your pack ready. Then you go downstairs, get your boots back on. You fill up your water bottles and then make sure you've got either a map, or a lot of people just use an app on their phone with a downloadable GPS. It's not really necessary. The trail is really well marked. Okay. Just for safety, you can very easily get free offline maps so that you can just follow your way. I think it's a smart idea in case of a storm. I have heard a story of the people who go in June and they're trying to get over a pass and it started to snow. And all of a sudden that snow turned into a blizzard, which they weren't expecting. And they were very seasoned hikers. So they're like, we can do this. And then quickly realized the weather was not great. So they actually followed the GPS. They couldn't see anything except for their phone.
Wow.
So yeah. Yeah, it's wild. I don't think that's a typical experience, but I think we have to definitely be considerate of all the changes with climate change. It's a little bit more unpredictable, the patterns, but these are the mountains. You do want to be flexible.
Okay.
Yeah. So from Fodor Vedla is all downhill, and people with good knees love that part. Me, I'm like, oh, sometimes you turn around and walk backwards a little bit. But you walk down for about an hour and a half through next to a stream, and it opens up into this valley that reminds me a little bit of Yosemite. So it's just beauty the whole time. From there, you'll end up at a place called Refugio Perdiru. I can't pronounce that very well. But it's another one of these refugios, but it has a bus access, and a lot of people will come there that aren't necessarily hikers. They just want to stay in this beautiful place in the mountains, and that's a great lunch spot. So they have a stream there that a lot of people take off their boots and just soak their feet. Almost all the refugios have lounge chairs, too, so you'll see a lot of people take their boots off and just sit and have a drink or relax with some coffee, and it's just idyllic.
And you have called these huts before, which is really a misnomer because these are like four-story hotels.
Yeah, they're like that. They're nice. Yeah, they're nice. So in German, it's a Hütte, and Italian's a refugio. Hut, I know, I don't think hut really sums it up. So
people are expecting that they're sleeping in a hut with the trying to close the door to keep out the cold. This is not the right mental picture.
No, it does feel like you're stepping back in time. I would say it's more like an alpine lodge. It's got the window boxes just spilling out with geraniums that are red and pink. And there's no such thing as like plasticware. There's white tablecloths usually. Yeah, they're really nice. Really nice. It's something that, I never had experienced that before in the States, but yeah. So from Perdiru, the ascent is not terribly steep, but it is a bit of a challenge. We previously have been in the Fauna Sens National Park, and then you cross over into the Della Dolomiti National Park. You really can't tell the difference, like park to park, but they have it kind of has a different kind of geological structure. So you leave behind the sort of white limestone, and then you enter into more like massive green mountains with the peaks are made out of dolomite. So they tend to turn reddish in the afternoon. So I actually like to take my time and stay down in the valley until actually stay there a couple hours and relax, because the hiking, when the light starts to shift down, just makes the most beautiful colors along the stone faces.
Okay.
Yeah. And you keep walking up, and the night stop is in this valley, a small valley with, I believe, two different glacier lakes. And there's three different huttas or refugios around it. And we like to stay at a place called Lavarella because it has its own brewery and it has a barrel sauna in the deck. So you get to really recover after the day's hike. It's quite popular for mountain bikers on tour as well, like where people, groups of mountain bikers will basically bike pack across the Dolomites too. So it's a nice place. And here it's like marmot are poking their heads up about 10 feet away from you when you're sitting on the deck. And the cows, there's just 100 cows, all with bells. And they're brave. They come up on the deck sometimes too. which is quite surprising.
I'm guessing then if you're starting to see marmots that you're up above 9,000-10,000 feet by this point.
This, I think, is around 20, I can look it up. It's 2,500 meters, I think.
Okay.
We're getting close. Yeah, I think the highest in this section is 2,700 meters. Okay. Yeah. This
and that would be not, a little less than 9,000 feet. Okay.
I think so. Yeah. I think the Dolomites, if I read correctly, there's 18 peaks above 3,000 meters. And then lots of these other ones that are quite close. So, yeah, it's very jagged.
Okay.
Yeah. So, let's see. So, Lavarella, it has a really nice lake that's freezing cold. But surprisingly, if you jump in there, it helps your knees feel a lot better. So, I would recommend hikers do that. Okay. If you can sum up the courage, you're not going to stay in very long. But to get in there, it's like a cryotherapy or something where people can help their muscles recover.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's day two. On day three, Lavarella is, I would say, is not my favorite dining experience. It's more basic food. Still good mountain foods. And but then the third day, this is probably the most beautiful day, one of the most beautiful places you could walk through. But it's also really hard. So people need to be mentally prepared that it's a challenging day. And this is the one day along this section where there isn't a place to stop for lunch. So what you can do is buy a sack lunch from the Lavarella Hütte, where they'll pack you up a sandwich usually and an apple and some hard-boiled eggs. And you'll want to make sure to take enough water for the entire day, because I don't remember any springs in this section, because it does get up pretty high and you're going over two very stony mountain passes. I think Lavarella, it has a lot of springs, so you can just fill up as you. Some of the huts are actually on the top of a cliff, and so they have to use a gondola to bring up bottled water for everything. So that part depends whether or not you have to buy your water or not.
Okay.
Yeah. So this day you go up, you pass through three different lakes, some different monuments, and then a valley opens up again with the cows and the marmot. And you walk down this valley, and honestly, most of the time you're not really seeing a lot of other people in this section. You may at the very beginning run into some people, but often you'll just have the trail to yourself, which is surprising because it's so popular, but it's really nice. You'll climb up this not treacherous but very steep uphill, and it comes to basically like a V between two massive stone peaks, and you get to the top there. And last year I saw someone jump off of it in a bat suit. We were like, we can barely manage to walk up this thing, and then there's someone's jumping off in a bat suit. It's crazy. But that's usually where people like to stop and have lunch, because you're really tired and need some calories. But from there at that peak, you can look down and there's a green lake at the bottom of what seems like a staircase. It seems steeper than that somehow. And there's been a trail that's a zigzag trail cut. And it's quite fine once you start going down it, but just the optics of it, it just seems so crazy. And what's really strange is that this was actually a place in World War I where soldiers were trying to take cannons that were situated at the top. Hmm. When you think about all the World War I history in this area, it's a little bit humbling, because really, most fairly fit people are huffing and puffing just walking it, not to mention the fact that this was a site of massive conflict. But yeah, from there you walk down and take a break at the lake. A lot of people like to swim. Again, you have to have that desire to be a polar bear. I get to about my knees and then I'm out. And then from here, you walk up to the Refugio Lagazzoi. There's a ski resort there, but also during World War I, this was the Paso Falzarego was an important location for the fightings between the Italians and the Austro-Hungarians. And mm-hmm. there are actually quite a few remains of bunkers on both sides of the trail. So you can see the structure of where you can see where they had machine gun nests, where they had different bunkers. They're not necessarily the kind that you would want to walk into. They look more ruined than that, but okay. you can definitely see, you can really picture in your mind how things went down. And from here, it's up, and it looks like you should take a right and go up what looks like a ski pist, but you do not want to do that. You stay to the left and walk up the normal trail. And from there, you'll get to where the gondola comes up from the valley. And here's where you'll start to see crowds. So this is the part where you'll see quite a few people.
This is where you might see me on the trail, you're saying.
I love this because I see people in wheelchairs. So it is a crazy walk up. But if you use a bus from Cortina d'Ampezzo, you can be dropped off at this Paso Falzarego and take a gondola, like a very large gondola. And there is a short trail to the restaurant and refugio from the gondola, but it's manageable with a wheelchair. So that's it's really nice to see people get to experience being on basically a 2,700 meter cliff top restaurant deck, etc., all together. And then you're basically on a saddle, so you're going to see down into the valley where Paso Falzarego is, and you're going to see down the valley on the other way. You just really do feel like you're on top of the world. And Refugio Lagazoi has a very large deck that everyone should have a chance to sit there and have a coffee and just be inspired.
Okay.
Yeah. And this one is one of my favorite refugios because they also have a barrel sauna. But the barrel sauna has windows and it's set on the deck, on the edge. So you can be sitting in the sauna looking out 20, 30 miles of mountains while you're taking a sauna.
Excellent.
Yeah.
And then you got one day left.
Yeah. So this is where there starts to be options. Every year we do it different, which is keeping it spicy. After breakfast, because it has the cable car coming directly to it and it's quite popular, this family-run refugio, they boot you out. They get you moving because okay. they have to get ready for the lunchtime swarm. And in fact, last year we had, I think, 20 people in a family reunion in the room next to us from Venice. So there's a lot more people there. Mm-hmm. But you can either choose to wear a headlamp and go...
Oh, and go a little early. Okay.
No, I don't think you could, I guess. I don't... It's not as hot. It's not that hot, or it hasn't been in my experience going in August and July, that you need to get up really early. Like some people in Spain, if they're doing the Camino walks, you need to get up early because it's so hot. But there are tunnels from the top because there was trench warfare.
Sure.
Like crazy in World War One. And there was so much carnage. People built tunnels in the glaciers. They built the tunnels in the stone. It's incredible. So you can actually, I've met a lot of people who have done it. This will be our first year planning to do it. We've done other routes, but from what I hear, don't wear flip-flops. Make sure you have good shoes and a headlamp. And you can walk down about 2 miles through tunnels. And it's almost like a sheer cliff. Like when you see this, when you're at the bottom of the valley and you're looking up at the refugio, it looks tiny. It looks so small. But they've dug tunnels the whole way. So you get intermittent portals. Like I've gone a little ways down and you walk down, it's dark as dark. And then there'll be a hole in the rock looking out over this valley, which is really cool. So that's one way down. If you don't like walking downhill, a lot of people don't, you can actually just take the gondola down, which is like a little shortcut. Or you can traverse 3 miles, basically slowly going down into the valley.
Okay.
Yeah. But the thing is, once you get down in the valley, you got to go back up.
Okay.
So, because on the other side of this valley, this is the famous Cinque Torri, which is a five towers.
Five
so
towers, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's beautiful. There's a set of 3 or 4 refugios on that side. we've taken the path where we meander up about 2 hours and you get to do a little bit of rock scrambling, or you can walk around it if you want to. So it's not really like super adventurous, but it's a little bit of fun, especially for the kids. And you come out across the Avro rock formation and you're just walking along the side. And here you've got the Refugio Sciatoli, the Refugio Avro, and then the Refugio Cinque Torri to either eat or stay at. We've been at two of them and they are phenomenal. I would say Refugio Avro, again, it has a possibility of a chairlift to get to it. So you get people who aren't hiking, they can just come up here for lunch and it's phenomenal. Like, they have a 30-year-old recipe for ravioli where they use mountain herbs, like wild herbs, nuts and cheese. It's just, oh, so good. And this is definitely a better dining experience than some of the other ones. So yeah, at Cinque Torri, there is basically an outdoor museum. So they've set up dozens and dozens of placards in English, German, Italian. So you can really read about the World War I experience. And they have machine guns set up, so you can, like, how they were pointed, and they would tell you, like, how often they would, how many shells they would use per day. And they were basically aiming at the Refugio you were staying at the night before.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah. There's also quite a lot of rock climbers, so that's fun to watch these spider people climb up what seems impossible high cliffs. Okay. And once a year, there is a symphony and light show. We missed it by one day last year, which was very sad, but we saw all the people setting up like a concert style light show where they beamed the light onto the stone of the Cinque Torri while they had a live orchestra. Yeah.
Sure. Excellent. So that is our last day. Are we back now in...
From here,
we're really close to where we started.
Yes. So either you walk down a forest path back to Cortina d'Ampezzo, or you just hop on one of the buses that are nearby that'll take you back to Cortina d'Ampezzo, and you should treat yourself to a spa day.
Excellent. Yes. And obviously then, as you said, if you have more time and you're willing to let your kids hate you, there's more that you could do further south. A couple more days. Excellent.
Yeah, about 6 or 7 more days you can go.
Excellent. Anything else we should tell people before we get to some of our wrap-up questions?
There's a lot to it, but
we'll point people at your website too here in a couple minutes here and talk about where they can find more information. But you are standing in the prettiest spot on this whole trek. Where are you standing and what are you looking at?
After all the crowds leave, on the deck of Refugio Lagazzoi at sunset.
Are you in the barrel sauna, or are you or are you not in the barrel sauna?
At this point, I'm out of the barrel sauna. Okay. I've showered. I've got my slippers on, and I'm sipping a glass of Lagrein red wine and just absorbing the nature.
Excellent. And one thing that makes you laugh and say only on the Alta Via 1 in the Dolomites.
Where people go, why did you make me do this? But I love you. It's the best thing I've ever done.
Excellent. And if you had to summarize this trek, this experience in just 3 words, what 3 words would you use?
Awe-inspiring freedom.
Excellent. Our guest again has been Morgan Fiedler from cravetheplanet.com. And Morgan, we're going to send people to your best post on the Alta Via 1 and the Dolomites on your website. Where are we sending them? What are they going to learn there?
Sure. If you go to cravetheplanet.com/Dolomites, I put the Excel spreadsheet and I put the planner. You've got it basically with all the huts listed and their phone numbers, so that if you wanted to plan your own, it's there. You can download it without any email or whatever. It's on Airtable, so if you like it on your phone, if you're like under the age of 35, or it's Excel for us older people.
Excellent. Thanks. Morgan, thanks so much for coming on Amateur Traveler and sharing with us your love for the Dolomites, for the Alta Via 1, for Italy.
It was a pleasure.
I'd like to extend my thanks to the patrons of the show who help support Amateur Traveler financially. They get an ad-free version of the show. That also means that they always have the chapters because ads don't get inserted, which some of you have noticed recently. And we get a monthly Zoom call and some other tchotchkes. If you're interested in becoming a patron of the show or at least learning more about it, you can go to patreon.com/amateurtraveler. I was pleased with the reaction I got to the show on Silicon Valley. As you know, I had some trouble deciding to do that, and I wasn't sure if people would like it or not, and so I was pleased that I heard from Tamar this week, or recently, that I heard from Tamar, who said I'd been listening to Amateur Traveler for 14 to 15 years or so, very off and on as motherhood and life have gotten in the way, but I just really loved this episode. I feel like I've gotten to know you so much better through it, and it really makes me want to come check out this area. I was surprised when I saw the episode title because I was thinking of the business side of the area, but I guess there is more than meets the eye. Thanks for hundreds of episodes that I've really enjoyed. Well, Tamar, thanks so much for listening. Yeah, there is more to do here than I think I realized. We just checked out a intra-city winery yesterday that near downtown San Jose, and it's just kind of fun to discover things like that in the city that I know and have lived in for years. And then I also heard from Mike, who checked out an older episode of the show, episode 550, which I think is the most downloaded episode of Amateur Traveler. It's about Tokyo, Japan, and Mike wrote, "Informative podcast, but as a longtime Tokyo resident, I would recommend checking out destinations in the western part of the city, too. First off, there are a number of cute towns along the Chu Central Line, such as Nakano, Koenji, and Kichoji, where you can find perhaps more local restaurants and pubs than anywhere else in the city. Cool shopping arcades, too. Kichoji has a wonderful little lake and a lovely pathway for romantic walks at sunset, one of the best places for cherry blossom viewings, too. A little further out, but still within the Tokyo area, is Maitakao. Day-long hikes to the summit provide breathtaking views, and there's a beer tent up there, too. Finally, just outside Tokyo, but an easy train ride, is the historic area of Kamakura. This place avoided much of World War II bombing and is a great place to see original Edo period buildings. Nice local suites there, too." And I'm surprised we didn't mention Kamakura in that episode, or maybe I hadn't been there yet, but I love Kamakura. I'm certainly with you that that is a really fun place to go. Some beautiful temples and shrines in that city. It's a coastal city also. And my apologies for the Japanese pronunciation. I do not, as you may have guessed, speak Japanese. With that, we're going to end this episode of Amateur Traveler. If you have any questions, send an email to host@amateurtraveler.com, or better yet, leave a comment on this episode at amateurtraveler.com. And thanks so much for listening.